This has been a great experience for me these last two or three days, and I have been so thrilled with the atmosphere of your campus, apart from the fact that so many people wear ties here, and for some of us more laid-back ones, that would be an adjustment, and that was just so wonderful. And chapel was such a great experience for me today. To hear a big organ like that and to hear the band and to see a tiny bit of what Dr. Stamm does, it's just been a great experience. Chip asked me to just share a little bit about the ministry that has occupied almost half of my missions career. I've spent over 30 years with Operation Mobilization, a mission agency of some 4,100 missionaries working in 110 nations of the world, and also two mission ships, the Logos and the Doulos. And I shared in one of the earlier classes that I met the lovely lady who became my wife on that ship. I met her out in India. She's from Sweden. And we got married in London, and our daughter was born in Argentina, and our son in Germany, and then we adopted a couple kids from India. And so that's what happens when you keep moving. And little did I realize when I was a music teacher teaching in a couple Bible colleges in Kansas, I had grown up as a preacher's kid in Philadelphia. And early in my sojourn, I somehow had a desire to link music and missions and had no way of knowing how to do that. And then I had a music group on tour, and we ended up at a Operation Mobilization training conference. And so they invited the group to sing. This was down in Dallas in the 70s. And then I asked the wrong question. I said to the director, well, could you ever use music in missions? And he pulled out a picture of this big ocean liner ship and said, we've just purchased a ship. And so I had the privilege of going to the Logos in the 70s. It was then the only ocean liner mission ship in existence. And I began to just see some amazing things of what God would do. We went to the Maldive Islands. Anyone ever heard of the Maldive Islands? One or two? Southwest of India. I was asked to see the Minister of Education for the whole country, thousands of islands, to set up a soccer match. They called it football. And the way that the ship would get into a country is we would invite people to visit the book exhibition on board. And the book exhibition, probably about a dozen of these rooms, about twice as long, and so about 3,000 titles on display, a huge bookshop. And the general public would come on and be able to purchase books, and we would have Christian books as well, Bibles and so forth. So the Maldive Islands was considered one of the most fanatical Muslim countries back in the 70s. There were only a couple known believers in the entire nation. And so the ship went in, and I went to visit the Minister of Education to gather some students together so that we could have a friendship evangelism with some of the guys. And so as I was sitting in his office, I tried to explain who we were in as low-key a way as I could so as not to put the ship in danger, because fanatical Muslims are fanatical. I didn't have much hair then. I wanted to keep what I had. And so I said, well, many of us come from the West, and as you know, in the West we have a Christian culture. And the moment I said Christian, he said, sir, You ever heard of the a book called the Old Testament? I said, yeah. Trying to act casual. He said, do you have any of those books in your bookship? And I didn't bother explaining the Bible, and I said, yeah. He said, have you ever heard of another book called a New Testament? I said, I think I've heard of that one as well. And he said, do you have those on your ship? And I said, well, we have a few, and I should have said a few thousand. And then he said, I understand that somewhere in history they made a copy, putting the old and the new part together in one volume. Have you ever seen that? This is the minister of education of a whole nation. And I said, yes, I've seen that. It's called the Holy Bible. And I said, and we have a very simple to read English version called Living Bible. And then in a very guarded tone, he said, can you get me one? May have been the first Bible, certainly for an official multivitalist. The aftermath of that story was that after we got organized, we decided to give a freebie to all those that would buy a book from the bookshop. They could choose from this big pile, very colorful book called, I think, The Living Way, which was the New Testament with pictures. Or they could go over here, this very small, dusty cover-looking thing of poems. Well, as you can imagine, they all went to this one. And about 1,000 of those got into the islands. After the ship left, they discovered what they were, and they called for a nationwide confiscation of those New Testaments. And about 300 of the 1,000 came back. The others went underground. And there is now a hidden group of believers who, when they are discovered, go through great persecution in the Maldives. Anyway, that's a little snapshot of life on a ship. And as I mentioned, I met my wife on board. And we are right now renovating a new vessel to replace the Logos called Logos Hope. And my role on board was to organize the music ministry. And so we always had music teams that would sing at our receptions on the ship, go to churches and sing. And we would put on international festivals in each port. We had people from 30 different nations. And so when they came to the vessel, we'd say, bring your national costumes. And so we would have dances and folklore from around the world, and we'd sing songs in Spanish or whatever. And then after all of the folk and the culture, then we had one of the music groups sing a Christian concert, and then we would present the gospel. And in the more open countries where we could call people to make a decision, we would see people come to Christ. And what a tremendous 14 years that I had on both the Logos and the second ship, the Doulos. And so that's one of the ministries of Operation Mobilization. Our career missionaries work in the mostly in the Middle East. We're the largest missions team in the Middle East. And we work interagency very much there. And so we're very well connected with the IMB. And in my own work, I am quite associated with the IMB music missionaries. And I just am planning to connect next month with Tom Ferguson, an IMB missionary who is involved in music. And his role is to help places where they are setting stories to music. And we hope to cooperate on many projects into the next few years. So music missions has been my background, and that's what brings me here. And I also had the joy in the last few months of releasing a book of stories, a reader of how God has used music around the world. And what is unique about this book is it has a CD-ROM in the back which explains in more detail with audio or video the stories that are in here. And as I may have mentioned in one of the classes, in fact, some of the audio and video that you're seeing is also captured in this book. So it's a way to have a little memory of our sessions together. And the first story comes out of the Sudan, where one man saw the Jesus film almost 100 times. And then when the soldiers came in to just destroy that part of the south of Sudan, the Campus Crusade Jesus film team had to escape. But the man who lived there was able to do what he saw the film team do, go to village, city to city. And because he didn't have the Jesus film, he decided to write out the Jesus film in the form of an epic song. And the Campus Crusade people say that it was on 17 pieces of paper. And he memorized this epic song that just went from story to story right through the Gospel of Luke. And he would go from place to place singing that epic song. And he saw people come to Christ and 46 churches planted. That's the first story in this book. And there's 44 others just like that of how God has dynamically used music. So get a copy of that book. They'll be available as you leave. Several years ago, I was asked to write an article for this missions magazine called Trends in Global Worship. Some of you got a copy of this in the last session. And let me just see if I can get this turned on. If you could just switch me over. Okay, great. And and so there were several trends that were mentioned. I remember writing about the worship explosion around the world and how Western music, pop music, had spread around the world, and also how there was this growing interest in people discovering their indigenous and ethnic roots. And on, several of those trends. And if I were asked to update that article, I would probably start with two overarching trends now in global worship. And that's what I want to share about today and then give you some illustrations of that. Trend number one comes out of the Urbana Mission. Those of you that were here last session heard some of the music from Urbana 2000. Well, also at Urbana 2000, you can imagine the impact that this had on many of us, because the very opening words of this global gathering, the first words were this: Urbana is about worship. Now that's stunning, stunning. He went on to say Urbana is about worship leading to mission, and mission leading to worship, all in response to God's initiative and great love, because He first loved us. Well, then, the worship leader, who also you heard in the last session introducing and singing in her best possible American accent of some Mandarin. So Sundi Fraser, in her opening statements, after she led a few songs, if God is love, how can we leave worship times unmoved by the plight of those who don't know His love? After spending an hour in God's presence, how can we not tell our family, our friends, or future friends about Jesus? True worship, then, should motivate me to share the love of Jesus just as I have experienced it in worship. Do you see what was happening? Urbana was making this connection, mission and worship morph together. Mission and evangelism morph, evangelism and worship morph together. Music and mission have connection. And Urbana is a great example of how this trend has just developed so wonderfully. Well, others also at that event. I think it was Steve Hoke, who might have been quoting a guy by the name of Steve Hawthorne, went right to Psalm 96. Tell of his glory among the nations, his wonderful deeds among all peoples. Why this global song of proclamation? The basic rationale of world evangelization is reduced to this. God reveals his glory to all people. And of course, we would add, he does that through you and me. He doesn't just have people look at the stars or the trees and figure out all of redemption. We see aspects of God's greatness and creativity, but it's a message. So God reveals his glory to all people so that he may receive glory from all people. Now, one of the great voices, and I shared in far more detail last session, that has also been articulating this, has been John Piper. And Piper has so many great statements about this connection, this new trend of connecting worship and mission. Piper wrote of one of his famous ones, all of history is moving toward one great goal, the white hot worship of God and his Son among all the peoples of the earth. The Great Commission is first to delight yourself in the Lord and then to declare, let the nations be glad and sing for joy. So that's that first trend, the whole concept of worship and mission. Now, there was a second one that I would spend more time on if I were rewriting that article in Mission Frontiers, the reawakening of indigenous culture. In the growing family of worshipers, people are longing for and discovering their ethnic roots. Believers are discovering the joy of expressing their love for Jesus in their own heart, culture, and language. In April, I will be sending a team to China. And the whole purpose of going to China is to work with a people group called the Zhuang, Z or Z-H-U-A-N-G. 17 million of them, 9 different dialects of Zhuang that are spoken. The Zhuang are the largest ethnic minority in China. But, listen to this, the Zhuang speak a language that has not yet had a Bible, and the only way that they can worship Jesus is in some other language. Think of the tragedy. So as the trade language across China is Mandarin, they have to sing in a foreign language. Imagine in chapel if we had to sing Japanese, and that was the only way that we could experience worshiping the Lord. So the Zhuang have had this growing desire. We would like our own song in our own dialect and tongue. And so a team will be going in April to meet with some Zhuang musicians And they are going to be setting some of their newly translated scriptures. They don't have the whole New Testament. They only have little portions. And we're hoping to see worship songs emerge. I'm actually working with the IMB on this. It's wonderful how the International Mission Board has is taking this by the handle and really running with it. Well, this is a trend that is happening in so many parts of the world. While there is the relentless spread of Western culture, mostly through television, Coca-Cola, and a few other things. By the way, I was in the middle of Mongolia on a freezing day. And some of you might have seen some excerpts from a video that took place on that trip where I had not one but two of those stocking hats on. It was for a bald head. It was so cold. And we went into this dilapidated tea shop to get something hot to drink in some obscure part of Mongolia. There was nothing in sight, nothing that you could see for miles except sheep. There's four times the number of sheep as people in Mongolia. So it was like 40 minutes of driving and seeing nothing, and we finally saw a place to have a rest stop and something to drink. We walked into the store, and here was this gigantic poster of Michael Jackson in the middle of this totally deserted place of Mongolia. Well, so you have this relentless spread of westernized things, but in the midst of all of that, there is this reawakening of indigenous culture. Take the example of a South American Indian. A Wycliffe translator was translating the Bible into her language. And when this lady would go into town, away from her village, going to a city, well, she had to speak Spanish. But that's not her preferred language. She had to put up with Spanish. So the Wycliffe missionary was trying to get this tribal group in a village to just hear some of the worship songs. And so he played a Spanish song written by a South American. And he said to the lady, "Tell me what you think." And the lady said, "Well, it's nice. But when we hear and sing our music in our language, we cry." See the difference? Last week, or 2 weeks ago, I was at Liberty University. And I was doing a different set, similar stuff, but a few different themes. And at the end of one of our sessions, one of their choirs came. It was a room about this size. And so they just surrounded the outer edges. And so after my class finished, about the same size as this, in came the choir. And they started to sing some songs that had become very meaningful to me personally from the Brooklyn Tabernacle Choir. And as I began to hear them sing, something just got uncorked in me, and I just began to weep and weep and weep almost uncontrollably. Why? Because that music has a deep connection to my emotions. A deep, deep, deep connection. In fact, when I was preparing on heart music in another session, I was going to play the opening. Larry Goss, this amazing orchestrator, has this film music, kind of rich, sonorous string opening. And every time I hear that, my muscles just begin to churn, because that music, I just so respond to these gigantic 6 and 7 note orchestral string chords. And that day, as this choir sang, and what also got to me was not only that they were singing, but they were singing with such wholehearted devotion. Especially some of the blacks. I just hope your campus gets many more blacks. There is just some, and they sang, they didn't sing the India way where you thin out your female voice. These gals sang with this full-throated, let it all out. If I tried to sing it, I would get hoarse the way they do it. And they were just so physically moved. Some had their hands in the air and some were moving. And I just wept. Now, here's the point. And here's the point of that South American lady. Everyone has that connection emotionally to their own music. And every people should worship our awesome God in an awesome way that reflects their own culture. And that's why I bother to stand before you, because it's that statement that wakes me every day and gives me focus and perspective. Every people should worship our awesome God in an awesome way that reflects their own culture. And God needs to raise up an army. And He may need you to be part of that army, to go out and to help capture and help encourage and facilitate another people group coming to worship God in their own heart, language, and music. Think of this incredible joy that I had in grad school. We had just gotten music that had come from a Wycliffe translator. And he brought it back to class, and we analyzed it. We figured out, when the melody moves around like this, does it go up there? No, it kind of moves down. And so we had all of these examples, and we made charts of how they sang on autopilot. They don't write this down. It's just part of the culture of this island in the Solomon Islands. And we analyzed it, and then we studied the rhythm. And they had kind of like this dotted rhythm that we saw in most of their songs. So we charted that. Now, this Buin people had never, ever had one Christian song. It was a pre-Christian group that were just getting the Bible. So after we had analyzed this music, the professor then said, now, what I want you to do is to write some prototype Buin tribal songs that emulate their style. Can you imagine the joy that we had of making these prototypes for a people that had, they're pre-Christian and able to put some of their newly translated scriptures to a Buin style of music. The reason that I bothered with this, collecting these stories, goes back to one statement that I heard. I want to tell this in every class. I think I forgot to tell it in the last class, so I need to repent. I heard one statement that so galvanized me. Many people say they are changed by reading a book. I enjoyed reading Don Husted's book over the last couple days. Great stuff in there. Well, I was changed just by hearing a quote. The then head of Wycliffe stood up in a meeting in Pretoria, South Africa, 1997. It was in July, and it was freezing in South Africa. Shall never forget that moment. And I had just given a report about some of the stuff that I shared about in this magazine issue. And it was not his turn, but the head of Wycliffe stood up and said, people, what Fortunato has just said, I want to underscore. And he said, here's how I want to underscore it. I want to share with you two things about Wycliffe. And he then went on to say, where the translators got the new believers to sing newly translated scriptures in their own musical styles, churches grew rapidly. Where that did not happen, sentence number two, where that did not happen, churches grew slowly. Now, people, how do we want to see the church grow connected to their music? That second trend is so vital and so important. Well, let me just show you one more thing to illustrate this so that you just don't ever, ever miss it. If we look at this as an arc that may represent the music of the world, what you and I love, what I wept over at Liberty University is probably not more than a sliver of the arc. It's just a sliver. Now, it sounds big to us because it gets recorded and it moves around on television, but in terms of the total picture worldwide of all the music, of all people, it's just a sliver. So what these classes are all about is the rest of that arc and the people that need to worship Jesus in the rest of that arc, and not forcing those people into this little bandwidth. We don't force people any. This was the 19th century error of many missionaries. They had no experience here. They didn't know how to handle any of this. And so they forced all believers into this. And we need to, of course, build on that heritage of others. Well, for the rest of our time then, what I want to do is to just illustrate this second trend through various pictures and audio pictures of that. But before I do that, let me just walk you through a very important thing. And let me just have you think about non-Western music. Those of you that were here yesterday got a little of this, but I just want to build on it. Let's just think about intervals, firstly. In the Middle East, pitches can be 3/4 tones apart or 5/4 tones apart. Did you know that not all pitches around the world follow a sequence as found on our piano? The use of quarter tones, that's in between the crack, is found in Africa and Chinese music. Now, how many notes in the octave? How many pitches from one to the other? Well, quickly, 12. In Syria, in history, there were 53 different pitches within one octave. I have a synthesizer keyboard, and I can retune it to Syria. And one octave, of course, on the keyboard is about like this. I can make one octave that wide. Now, as the angels listen to people sing, would they have more interest in a person that can sing in 53 pitches within the octave or just a few?
We don't know.
Unfortunately, Chip and I have had to put up with singers that were singing in those cracks. Made the angels happy. It didn't make our ears happy. The Arabs have had 17, 24, 25 pitches within one octave. How many different rhythms in Western praise? Come on, 2-4, 3-4, 4-4, what else? 6-8, 9-8, 12-8, what else? Cut time, what do we got, 7 or 8, maybe 9? The Peking Opera uses 60 conventional rhythmic patterns all the time. There's at least 100 functional rhythms in everyday use in India. Here's some Arabic rhythm. Let's just look at this. Now, in the West, we would divide 9-4 into 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-3. Clap that with me, just on the downbeats. Ready? Go. 1-2-3, 1-2-3. Great. What a talented, talented seminary. Now, 9-4 can also divide 1-2-3-4-5-6-7-8-9. Clap this with me. Ready? Go. 1-2-3-4-5-6-7-8-9. Some of you were not so talented on that one. Do it one more time. Here we go. 1-2-3-4-5-6-7-8-9. Exactly. That's also 9-4. Now, here is a very predictable waltz-like thing, but there's so many different ways of expressing that. And as the Arabs say, we don't bother thinking about it. We just feel it rather than try to see it. Now, what I'd like you to do is to just hear two or three examples of some of this. I want to play again some of these non-Western scales. If you'll go to track 13. Some of you, this will be review because you heard this yesterday. We're on Planet Musician. Sorry. My fault. Thanks. 13. Hey, I'll play that in a minute. I went there to hear that. It's not out of tune. People sing that scale. This is my favorite. Okay, thanks. That's one of my favorite. By the way, how many were in chapel today? How deep the Father's love? Remember? Were you aware that that was a rhythmically mixed treatment between threes and twos? And a very, very nice, very, very nice treatment using three pattern and two patterns. And because of time, I'm not going to spend some time there. But if you'd like to get a real taste for global worship, here is an around-the-world example, 22 tracks from every continent in this double CD. It's all actually put on one CD, but it's the length of a double one. And let me just give you a one-minute excerpt, if you'll go to that one-minute thing. And I'll just play you just a few seconds of some of the tracks, and I think I can remember what country some of these come from. This is from Senegal. Senegal. Pakistan. We're in Bulgaria among the Turkish gypsies. Mongolia. We're now in Brazil. Samba. Ethiopia. I forget. And this is one of the contemporary sounds out of Mongolia. Okay, thanks. So if you want to take some global worship home with you, get this. And there's a special packet putting the two together at several dollars discount. Well, because of time, I think we're going to move on here and avoid many other examples. But I just want to touch on a final wrap-up of some sounds from around the world. And so I've gathered this potpourri of stuff that we didn't get a chance to listen to from different classes. So it's not nicely organized between Asia, Africa, and other places like I normally do. So at this point, let's listen to this. You're going to hear now this microtonal singing in between the cracks of what it sounds like to sing in those different scales, track 5. Hear the different tuning? He's not playing out of pitch. It's a different tuning. Different scales. Okay, thanks. What did I have next? Okay. I'd like you to hear the beautiful sounds of children in Central Asia that had never had their own music. And this is the very first batch of new songs for the Azerbaijan people. And Korean missionaries worked there, and they brought in their Korean culture, so it's Western, but because of the Russian influence, it worked with the children. What a joy it was to send that team to Azerbaijan, knowing that the kids were having their very, very first taste of their own songs. When we went to Mongolia, we discovered that there were only 3 children's songs for Christian children that were Mongolian origin. And so the joy that we had was to start a songwriters fellowship. And the next year, we sent the team back, and they had their very first children's concert. What fun that was.
Where you talked about the urban sound and the fact that, I mean, when we think about a ministry like yours, we're thinking authentic instruments and things that look like they were made in a hut somewhere, and yet so much of it is high tech, you know. What you explained yesterday at the lunchtime about the authentic Indian urban sound having a drum machine. Can you just, that it's a little bit of an oxymoron. Does it?
Well, what we're discussing here is this blending of cultural stuff, and that we work in both worlds of high tech, where we're using the very latest computer digital stuff. I got a ride last night home with one of the missions guys who's from the Clifton Church, who's getting his doctorate here, and he worked with the Jesus Film Project, and he told us about how they did that. I was chatting with Scott, who's back at the controls there. Scott was recognized some of our equipment here because he's a recording engineer, and we're working with this very, very high-tech kind of stuff. And at the same time, what we're going in is to capture some of the primitive instrumental sounds of people who want to use their instruments. And when we went to the Himalaya Mountains, they had never seen a white person or a black person on our, you saw the integrated teams that we send out. They had actually handmade their instruments. Now, was it worth sending a team to these tribal jungle areas of the Himalayas to capture their worship so that it could be spread across other villages and that we could send it back here and celebrate what God is doing around the world? Absolutely, yes. And so you had this mixture of having this battery-powered laptops to go and to capture the indigenous sounds of indigenous handmade instruments in a rural part of India. What an exciting thing that is. And I trust that that guy back there is going to get on some of those very teams. And we're going to make him sleep on the floor. And we're not going to give him a hot shower every day. And we're going to ask some of you to help pay for his airfare to get over there. All right, let's listen to one or two more before we close. And yeah, let's have that Songs of the Creator. Yeah, and let's see what track that was. Track three. While we're on the children's music, let's listen to another children's song. This one is from the North American Indians up in the far north Arctic. Oh, no, sorry. Oh, well. Sorry. Try four. Oh, grief. I got tired last night. All right, never mind. Next time I'm here in the next 10 years, you'll hear the children of India. Let me just end with one more beautiful example, and then we'll see if any of you have any questions. Put on the Nepal. Keep it in your heart. Yeah, thanks. Number track three. Just before you play that, can you just hold a second? What's it like to have the joy of going to a place and for the new believers to sing for the first time their songs? They never stood before a microphone before. And so it's not like they have practiced for years and years how to sing in a mic. The joy that we have of capturing the very first release of God's wonderful, beautiful, diverse worship in a place, and here you're going to hear the very first songs from this people group in Nepal. I think I'd like to close by just giving a final little testimony. Having been a music teacher for many years and having discovered about this ship that I went to, I had the joy of meeting a young lady on board that was in my music group. And we were on our way home from Delhi, India, 6,000 miles to London, where we were going to catch the plane to go home, get engaged, and get married. She lived in Montana. We never made it. On a foggy night in Yugoslavia, a drunken truck driver trying to overtake a vehicle did not get back in his lane in time. It was on a curved road. Plowed right into our Volkswagen van. 4 people were killed, including my fiancé. I awakened, having been in a coma in a hospital in Yugoslavia. And because of an eye problem that I had at that time, my lids did not close. And having been in a coma for a week, my corneas blistered and scarred. And when I awakened, I could not see. I was flown home on a stretcher and underwent several eye surgeries. And they restored a good bit of my vision. And I've just learned to live with the fact that having, you know, my eyes have been through being massacred. And I'm just grateful every day. Every day is a gift of life, and every day that I can see is a gift to me. So when I finally was able to go through the third surgery and had enough eyesight to be able to travel, I was so eager to just get out of the house. I had spent weeks in hospitals. And my father was a very close friend of a fellow Italian pastor in Upper New York, and so had arranged for me to go to that church and to play some piano arrangements and to give a little missions presentation. So I arrived on a Saturday, and before the evening meal, Pastor Palma said, "Frank, I want you to go into my study. Go down my basement, go into my study, and I'll call you up for the meal. But while you're waiting, I want you to put the cassette tape on that I put in the player, and I want you to hear a message that I preached, because I preached it as your funeral message." Well, that got my interest. And so Pastor Palma put the tape on, or I put the tape on of Pastor Palma's sermon. And in the sermon, he said, "People, please pray for Reverend Fortunato's son, Frank Jr., who's just been in an accident. And several people were killed. And the American embassy said they don't know if Frank is going to live. He's had these broken bones, concussion, and they said the report from the hospital was that if he did live, there might be brain damage." My kids presumed that there was brain damage. There might be brain damage, or he might live as a vegetable the rest of his life. But they don't know. He's in a coma. And so they had prayer. And then Pastor Palma on the tape said, "People, as my sermon today, I want to address some remarks to my good friend, Reverend Fortunato." Dad was alive then in Philadelphia. And so Pastor Palma began his sermon. "Brother Frank, if you never get to see your son, Frank Jr. again, remember one thing. One thing, Brother Frank. Psalm 63. Because your loving kindness is better than life itself, I will praise you." And Pastor Palma said, "Brother Frank, the love of Jesus that brought your son to himself means that one day you're both going to be with the Lord and you'll see Frank again." And so what Brother Palma was doing was preparing Dad for my death. And I was very moved by it. It was such a comforting and an appropriate word as I could just imagine what Mother and Dad Fortunato were going through. Well, so they didn't call me up for the meal, and so I was still waiting there, but I was so deeply moved by this. So the next thing I did was I just wanted to read the rest of Psalm 63. So I had Bibles, and so I grabbed the Bible. I don't know which version I was reading back then, but I started reading the Psalm, then I went to the next verse. And the next verse said, "Therefore, I will praise you as long as I live." And people, all I can say is that it's like I was in a dark room. And in a sense, emotionally, I was, because I didn't know why I was alive. In fact, I was feeling so intimidated. "Lord, there must be something wrong with me. Why am I not in heaven with you? Why am I not with my friends who all went to be with Jesus? What's wrong with me that you had to leave me behind?" And the evil one was pounding me with this. And then I think God was just waiting for me to come to that point. And I got to those words, "Therefore I will praise you as long as I live." And all I can say is because this was like in flashes of just split seconds. And these impressions were like hitting me one after another. And as I just, the words were reverberating, "I praise you as long as I live." God began to just reorient me. And I began to sense God saying things like this: "Frank, you have been a musician for me, but I rescued you because there's a higher calling on your life." And those words were reverberating, "I will praise you as long as I live." And I sense God saying, "Frank, if it means more accidents, if it means sickness, whatever it is, learn to praise me. That's your calling. That's why I left you behind. You have to learn more of that." And so that started me on a whole new journey of wanting to learn about worship. And then one day, many years later, I was at an Operation Mobilization summer campaign called Love Europe. There were about 7,500 people from some 70 or 80 nations, and I was the program coordinator, and I was getting upset because they were arriving late, and Graham Kendrick was up there with the praise band, and I'm looking at my minute-by-minute program. Do I have to drop a testimony here, or do I have to get a signal to the music team to drop a song? And, you know, and I'm all preoccupied with program. And so then the next thing was I wanted to just see how many empty seats were there, and so I stepped out behind the backstage and I took a look and I saw people worshiping God from these 75, 80 nations. The Koreans were more elegant. The South Americans were jumping in the aisle. There was this massive, beautiful body of Christ worshiping in their styles. God just whispered again to me. And what I sensed God saying to me was, Frank, I created you for moments like this. And I suddenly saw that my life was to connect with the people of God at worship, and that maybe I had to connect with ethnic worship in some way. And that's what led to what I'm doing now. So this stuff is just not casual. This is a calling, and that I trust some of you will have a calling to help people in places where they are just beginning to figure it out, that they can use their music and their worship, their styles, to praise the Lord. Well, any closing or final comments or any questions before we close? Yes. Great. Let me tell you about a program that we have called Move On. And it's the wrong phrase. I didn't know about this Move On movement. I was ignorant of American culture, but I had already printed 5,000 of these cards and I wasn't going to trash them. So we have a program called Move On where we invite people to have exposure trips. And so in June of this next year, we are taking a team to Jordan. And we're going to go into some Bedouin tents. And we're going to take some surveys among Islamic musicians. And we're going to work with the believers and hold some seminars on worship. And it's an exposure trip to kind of get a feel for music in the non-Western world and perhaps find a way where you can connect with them. We're going to do a little songwriting event among some, that we hope maybe some will be believers by then. But if not, they're going to set some psalms to their own music, and we're going to help facilitate them doing that. So get a card out there that's called Move On. Any other question?
Is your Heart Sound website hsi.org?
No. It's heart-sounds.org. And again, on those postcards, you'll be able to get our website, and we invite you to go there and one of those email addresses on there will reach me as well.